Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you?
What up, though?
Okay, we got the quick intro, so we actually have a guest this time. Joining us today for the first time is Indiana Fever winged Lexi Hull. Lexi, how are you?
I'm good. Excited to chat.
Excited to have you here. Thank you for taking some time out. I have plenty of basketball questions for you. But before we hop into the basketball side, I wanted to ask, where did the interest in golf come from?
So I actually grew up in a town called Liberty Lake, and there's three golf courses in like the little suburb in Spokane, Washington. So My family grew up golfing. I wouldn't say I grew up golfing a lot, but definitely had a club in my hands at an early age. So
Got you. What was your best score?
Oh gosh, I'm not good, guys. My best score? It's gotta be, I think, I mean, like 90? Yeah. 85 maybe once upon a time, but I'd say 90 to 100 is the average.
Okay, got you. See, top golf is where I stop, and I am not that good at it, so it's a very, very rare thing for me. Do you have a favorite golfer?
I would say Stanford. I went to Stanford, so Tiger Woods is definitely up there.
That would do it. Yeah. And then circling back to the summer, just get something on the music side really quickly. You and Caitlin Clark were on stage for the Jordan Davis concert. How was that experience? Like, how did that come together?
So he just reached out and was like, you guys want to come? Because he was performing in Indianapolis and asked if we wanted to come to the show. And then when we got there, he's like, you guys want to come at the end and like come on stage? So of course we said yes, but I mean, it was way more nerve wracking than I was expecting. Like I was more nervous for that than I am for like a basketball game. Cause there's just thousands of people out there like looking only at you. Thankfully I didn't have a mic in my hand. So yeah, it was fun.
Well, based on that, are you not a singer?
No, I mean, I sing, but you don't want to hear me. So
Fair enough. Are there any other artists that you want to hop on stage with?
Ooh, I mean, I'd really go on any stage, but I love Morgan. I'm a big country girl, so Morgan Wallen. I also love Noah Kahan right now. So, I mean, there's definitely a few I'd love to get up there with.
Okay, got you. But then we can hop into the basketball side. You're coming off a tremendous season, second half of the season in particular, where you just shot the Nets off of the hoop. But before digging into the on-court product, how do you consume basketball when you're not playing? Are you a frequent watcher, film watcher? Are you listening to podcasts? Or how do you kind of take in basketball when you're not playing?
I love seeing it live. So I'll try to go to as many games as I can. Go to a lot of the Pacers games now that I'm living here in Indy. Went to an Indiana game for the first time, went to a Stanford game this past weekend. So try to see it live as much as I can. But when I'm not, I'll turn it on the TV.
Who are some of your favorites to watch around the league?
I mean, I loved watching the Olympics this past summer. So everyone on that team is really impressive and obviously fun to play against and fun to play with at times. So, yeah, I think the U.S. did a really good job, you know, choosing that team and putting good people out there.
Oh, I'd asked on over your time, obviously went to Stanford, playing for the Fever. Has anything changed with maybe how your mindset goes to watching film or watching the game over the course of the years?
Yeah, I feel like going to Stanford, we did a lot of X's and O's scouting, trying to figure out, you know, how to play hard enough that we can take away things. And so I really enjoy like watching film now and seeing what the defensive plans are against some great players against some really hard actions to guard, because every coach kind of goes at it a different way. So it's fun to see like the schemes come to life with different teams.
Got you. Have there been any veteran influences on your film watching?
My coaches at Stanford, Tara Vandeveer and Kate Pay. Kate's now the head coach, but I think they watch film every minute they're out of practice. So they know what to look for. They know how to break it down for sure.
None of this surprises me. I went to Arizona State for 3 years. And so I had the pleasure of watching that Stanford women's basketball team plenty of times. And yeah, I understand.
would appear playing under and learning under a legend is generally a fruitful endeavor. Okay, going to your Fever season, looking at the offensive side of the ball, what is it like playing off of Caitlin Clark, Kelsey Mitchell, and Aaliyah Boston?
I mean, they make my job really easy, right? it's awesome. And it's really cool to see all of them just grow, not only from this year, but playing 3 years with Kelsey, 2 years with Aaliyah. They're so impressive. And I think it's really fun because they garner so much attention, obviously, from the other team's defense. So then it allows the other players, me included, to make cuts, make reads, and they're really good at finding, you know, those openings and giving the ball up when it's needed and finding the better shot. So it's really fun. And I feel really lucky to get to play with them.
Well, I do have one question, because I'm sure we're going to talk about the shooting, and the shooting was fantastic last year, but you mentioned the cutting. How has that kind of developed for you, obviously, throughout college and the W, as far as knowing when to cut, how to cut, how to punish defenses that way?
Yeah, I think it's like there's a bit of like holding back that needs to happen, but then also like knowing when to go. And definitely in college, there were times where I cut too much. I think that's like part of my game that had to be reeled back, because I would cut and it's like that you just took away the lane for someone else. But like, it was open. Well, so like I definitely learned when to space, when to like spread the floor out. But then also it's fun when the defense is stopped staring at the ball. That's a perfect opportunity to back cut, because they will know that you're going down to the basket. So it's just fun for me to get to read and really just read and react. I think that's really all cutting is.
I think bouncing off of the filling space portion of the program, I think something that pops with watching the Fever as a whole, but watching Caitlin when she's out there, just the passes that she is willing to try and some of the tight windows that she'll toss out there, obviously the transition outlets and stuff. How much of an adjustment was it for you to play off of someone that passes like that?
I mean, I definitely got passes and tried to finish when I wasn't expecting to get the ball. So like now it's like, okay, every cut I have, every cut I make, every fast break I run, like I have a real opportunity to get the ball, which mm-hmm. definitely like took me a second. And I think it really just took one of those to really get my head around like, oh, she's all the way down at the other end of the floor and she could still make the pass to me down at the block at this end. So, it's been awesome. And I think it's so fun to be able to know that you're not just cutting to cut, knowing that you're cutting with the possibility of like actually making a really cool play. So that makes it that much more worthwhile.
I think circling back to the balance that you were talking about and you saying that you cut too often sometimes, like, is it tougher in a way to kind of find that balance when you are playing with someone like Caitlin? Like, okay, maybe I shouldn't cut here, but she can actually make this pass anyway.
Yeah, it is. Cause it's like, everyone sees the game a little differently, right? So mm-hmm. like I might see the cut and I might think she sees the cut, but also the post could be seeing that lane and trying to post up. So it's like trying to make sure that all five people on the court are reading the defense the same way so that we're all in sync. I think that obviously takes time and that takes like building chemistry together. So it's fun. It's a fun part of the game because you're never really finished learning or finished growing together, because there's always room to get closer.
All right, now going to the shooting, as we both, Steve and I both talked about how amazing the shooting was for you, particularly post-Olympic break. Was there a jumper tweak? Was there just a level of comfort that you found? What would you attribute that kind of stretch to?
It was like clicking after the break. And I think a lot of it is mental. I didn't change anything about my shot. I didn't change the amount of shots I was getting in practice. I mean, like all of that preparation stuff stayed the same. I think one thing that our coaches did during that break, I mean, we had a full month of practice pretty much during the Olympic break. And they would put up every day after practice our shooting percentages from twos and threes during drills, during scrimmages, during everything. And I think that helped me because, and it, some people were probably like, it's so annoying, whatever, but I personally liked it because in my head, when I'd leave practice, I was like thinking about the five shots that I missed or the 10 shots that I missed, and not thinking about that, oh, maybe I did have a good shooting day. And I would look at those percentages the next day and realize I'm shooting like 60 to 70% in practice. I'm like, that's better than in my head I had imagined. So it gave me confidence that I was performing better than I think I was perceiving my performance. So I think it all comes down to like the mental side, at least for me in that second half.
Gotcha. I think actually bouncing off of that, like, how do you take in numbers as a basketball player? Because it feels like there's two strong competing rules of thought with analytics and stuff like that. So is that something that you just generally embrace?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like, numbers don't lie, unfortunately. And they're very drastic. My first 2 years, I was just so upset because I was putting in so much work and my shooting percentages, I would granted get like one or two at the max threes a game. So it's hard to be super efficient when you the pressure is really on for those couple shots. But the numbers don't lie. So it really allows you to look at improvements and really shoot for goals and keep yourself like accountable. And I really like that part of it. But also, I mean, outside of shooting percentages, some numbers don't necessarily dictate, you know, your impact on the floor. So I like numbers and I appreciate them. But also I think basketball is a game of real effort and skill. And sometimes numbers don't show everything.
Oh, it makes all the sense in the world.
It's facts right there. It's facts right there. I hope that soaks in, Nikias. No, numbers don't tell the entire story. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's something in my throat. Wow.
Okay. Welcome to the Shade Spot. Guys. Very cool. Very cool. Zooming back out, while we're talking about just general off-ball play, I'll toss a quick number out there for you, but you were one of the best players in the league last season in terms of attacking closeouts and attacking tilted defenses. I guess for you, how do you strike that balance between having a tilted defense and let me take the shot from the corner, take the shot from the wing versus let me attack and get downhill, find my own, or let me keep things moving. Let's make an extra pass. Let's keep them even more in rotation.
I think it's finding the best shot and good shots will be there. But there's a lot of times better shots and finding an open shot's the best shot. So for me, I felt like if I was open and a good chunk of the time I was because defensives collapsed on Kelsey and Caitlin and Aaliyah. But when they recover and I feel like they're recovering, that's when it's a good opportunity to drive and kick and make the extra pass because defenses are so hard. It's really hard to guard a team that's drive, kick because you're at a disadvantage basically the whole time. So then just until you find the best shot, that's, I feel like, the right time to take it. So sometimes it was me taking the best shot and other times it was the next pass or the pass after that. So just trying to read it.
Okay. Makes sense.
How do you, and I guess this is more just for people listening, because I think sometimes when you watch the game, you see, hey, they had a shot there. And so you mentioned the differences as far as when to attack, when to not. It's hard when you're out there and you're just kind of playing. You get the kick, you know the shot is there, but hey, I know if I can beat this closeout, I'm going to get someone else's shot. How has that kind of grown for you over the last couple of years for you to know, okay, I have the confidence not just to take the shot, but I also have the confidence to get this drive and make something better for my team?
Yeah, I think for me, sometimes it's like feeling the flow of the game. If Kelsey's hit six threes, like, and I can see she's to the right of me. And if I drive, she has a good open look, then we're going to feed the hot hand. And sometimes if I'm feeling good and I've hit a couple threes in the game and that closeout's a little tighter, but I'm feeling good, that might be the best shot. So it's just figuring out, you know, who has the hot hand in the moment and then reading the defense after that.
All right, let's transition to the defensive side of the ball. Was this always a strong suit of yours, just general on-ball defense, or is that something that you had to grow into?
Defense has always been like a big part of my game. Definitely a big part in college. But I think like for me, I always just pride myself and believe at the end of the day that defense is a lot of effort. And I think everyone could be pretty good at it. But I just don't think everyone wants to be. So I think that's like, I've always really held myself like high standards on the defensive side.
Come on. It's a Pacific Northwest Hooper. Of course she defends well. Come on.
That's what y'all do.
I'm from Oregon, wow. So I'm throwing it out there.
I respect it. Who were some of your influences defensively?
Back to Stanford, that's Kate Pegg. She would get in us. She was a scrappy player herself. And she would just teach us, you know, ways to get skinny, get around screens, get, you know, be in help side. They really focused on the defensive side. And she kind of led that at Stanford when I was there. So I would say her for sure.
Well, I was going to say, I think one of the things for me, and I'll just throw this out there, because when you watch Lexi play defense, you're all over the place. Off ball, on ball, you help, you recover, you fly around, you get after it. Is that, you know, you mentioned that's always been something you've done. How much time did it take to get comfortable doing that in the W?
I think I was always innately doing that, but I think the part that makes it more efficient, or I feel better about doing it now, is figuring out how to do those things without fouling. Mm. I think fouling really negates like a lot of the hustle that I bring, and I get so mad at myself, and I like obviously let the team down in certain situations if you end up fouling instead of just playing like solid defense. So that's something that I've definitely been working on, and still I feel like I'm doing better at it, but I still have a long ways to go. So I think that that's definitely kind of the learning curve there.
Okay. Who are some of your favorite players to match up with?
Ooh, favorite or least favorite? I mean, Arike is tough. She can hit some shots that like, you go like this because you're right there playing good D, contesting, and she hits some that just are really hard. I think people that are able to shoot a pull-up with a contested pull-up are tough. DT is really good at that. I know I fouled her down the trying to trail and hit her on the arm, and she got a couple free throws. I mean, people that can finish at all three levels, Jewel Lloyd. I mean, there's just a lot of people in the league that are really talented offensively and tough to guard, because when you can shoot behind a screen, you can shoot a pull-up, you can get all the way to the rim, it's really hard.
Yeah. I guess going back to your own locker room, what were those practice battles like with Caitlin, with Kelsey in particular?
I mean, it's definitely competitive. I think we have a really good group of guys that come and we play against them more. We play against them more often than we play against ourselves, at least this past year. So I know the guys got into it with all of us a few times, and it's a guy's a lot quicker. So trying to, you know, guard the guys and the guys trying to guard us, like we play a little bit of a different game. So there's definitely some good battles there.
That's just in bigger picture with your off season. I guess sticking with the Fever first, head coaching change, Christy Sides out, Stephanie White coming in. When did you find out, or just how did you kind of take in that news?
Yeah, I mean, we heard some whispers here and there, but really didn't find out until the world found out. And obviously, been with Christy for 2 years, and I think she's a good coach. She's a great person. She really is really big on building culture. So it's sad, you know, this will be my fourth coach in 4 years. So the transition here in Indiana, it's just pretty crazy. But I wish her the best, and I am excited about, you know, the future that we have and the experience we have coming in. So I think it's an exciting time for sure.
Yeah. Thank you. We're at the introductory presser for Stephanie White. What have been some of those conversations?
I mean, she seems great. She seems super excited to be here. Midwest girl through and through. So just really excited about the passion she's going to bring, the experience she has in playoffs. And just what she's going to do with our team. I think she's someone that everyone will respect as a player, as a coach, as a person. But I'm just excited to see, you know, what she does with us and how she changes what we already are doing well.
And then finally, you were announced as one of the unrivaled athletes. How did that come together?
Yeah, I'm excited. It should be a really fun year. First season in Miami. They reached out, and just really excited about the competition there, the different format. It's going to be a different game, different than any of us have ever played, full court 3-on-3. So just excited to compete and work on my game and get ready for training camp and get to play with and against, you know, some of the best in the league.
There you go. Anybody in particular that you're excited to play with or against?
I'm excited to play with Aaliyah, keep building that relationship. I'm excited to play with Dejanay. She was my Stanford, right? Teammate at Stanford for 2 seasons, so excited to rekindle that. And who knows what team everyone ends up, but just excited to see people there. Ryan and Alicia were also good friends. They were 3-on-3 and Athletes Unlimited, Alicia, but a lot of them. I mean, there's just so many. It's a good community in the W, and that community is transitioning to Unrivaled. So excited to build those relationships further.
Got you. You mentioned it's going to be... Oh, go ahead, Steve.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you mentioned it's going to be a different format. Like, Is there a, I guess, like a skill development type piece that you're kind of taking into the Unrivaled experience, or what are you planning on focusing on during that experience?
Yeah, so there's going to be a good, from what I've heard, a good group of coaches and people to train with while we're there. So I'm definitely going to take it as an opportunity to play games, but also work on my game and continue building what I've been building this offseason.
That was going to be the question I was going to ask. So we're good.
Well, you've done a pod with someone long enough.
It happens.
Before we get to Unrivaled in Miami in, I think, January, how are you spending the next couple of months? Are you vacationing? Are you already working out? How are you spending this time off?
I'm living in Indy. I did some vacationing right after season. Went to Paris, went to Hawaii, went to Austin. So I checked some of those boxes. I'll be home for the holidays. So just excited to spend some time with friends and family. But yeah, I've been here in Indy training with some of our assistants and just getting ready, working on getting stronger, getting better.
There we go. There we go. And then quickly before we head out of here, just wanted to mention that you did recently help serve meals at Tyrese Halliburton's Come to Our House Season of Giving Dinner. You are a voice in sport mentor as part of the WNBA's Changemakers program. And you partnered with Form, I believe, a basketball training aid co-founded by Gordon Hayward. I guess circling back to, I guess, the voice in sport portion, first and foremost. And just looking at the things that you posted on your feed, you seem to really enjoy giving back and connecting with folks. Like, has that always been something that you've looked to seek out?
Yeah, I think it's obviously a great opportunity to kind of share my story, share my journey, and getting to talk to girls that are going through the exact same things I was going through to get to this point and share, you know, my tips and tricks that I feel like I've learned and hopefully can help them. It's voice in sports giving a great platform to be able to do that. So I'm super honored to be able to talk to girls, talk to teams, and just share what I know.
Well, Lexi, thank you again for taking the time out and rocking with us for a little bit.
Thank you so much for joining us, Lexi. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was Fever Wing Lexi Hull. And now we can transition into the Dunker Spot mailbag. Once again, you can always send in basketball thoughts or questions if you have them. You can email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Our first question coming from Tony, who starts with, aha, what up, Dunk Kings? The early season has been really exciting for the hoopsickles out there. Those of us for whom the first full night of league pass is like Christmas morning, for whom Detroit versus Brooklyn on a Sunday afternoon is the ideal matinee. There's so much to watch, and you really can't watch everything live. I just can't get into multi-view. Call me crazy. Most nights, I'm locked in on my Hawks anyway, so naturally, the best answer is good old-fashioned film work, rolling up those sleeves and getting into it. I love going back to my playing days and digging into film. Here's the problem. I have a job, and sadly, as much as I love it, I don't work in basketball professionally. I'm a corporate sellout. So while I do watch full games, and I try to make use of the extended highlights on League Pass, I can't help but feel I could be more efficient with my film watching. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to reveal any patented trade secrets about how you watch film, but if I was inclined to build a process to identify a way to watch only the most important parts of a game, what would you recommend? For instance, I could scan a box score for a certain set of target stats, and depending on what I see, that might help me be more targeted with what I'm going to pay attention to in film. Does it make sense to just hunt for runs and watch that, or target specific lineup configurations that I find interesting, or maybe just always watching a specific set of minutes for every game? I'm open to any suggestions. I realize that the answer is probably any or all of the above, but I'm curious about what you two would choose to focus on if you wanted to apply a process to optimize your film watching.
Well, let's see what we can do here. I think for me, and it's not apples to apples, but let's say it's like a Thursday morning and maybe I caught a game or two. I'm not sure exactly what happened. I'm going to check the scores. I'm going to look. Be like, okay. Golden State won their fifth game in a row. They only won by three. I might watch the second half of that game. Or, hey, Cleveland did this blowout win. I might watch the first quarter or first half of that game. If there's an injury or there's a lineup change, I might want to see the first and third quarters of that game. If there's a team that defended really well, like let's say Orlando held a team like 85 points, I might want to see that stretch to where, okay, what was the defense like? But sometimes the box score can tell you a part of the story. And sometimes, especially as the season develops, you're going to know most of these teams, right? Like, so for me, I know Boston. you know, for me, it's always kind of like a rotation pattern. I know what Boston is. It's not that I'm not paying attention to Boston, it's that I know what they are. I'm going to check in with them, but early in the season, I'm more looking at the different teams, the newer teams, the teams that have different pieces. They're trying to figure certain things out. I might be locked in on the Kings more now than I'm locked in on the Celtics. I might be locked in on the Knicks more now than I am on, you know, the Thunder, because I know these teams and what they are. So it's more of a checkbox, checkbox, checkbox with those teams. With the other ones, you're trying to figure out, okay, well, Atlanta beat Boston. How did that happen? Let me watch the second half. You know, Miami was in a fight with Detroit. Detroit's fun. Let me watch that second half. So I think sometimes people can feel like they have to watch all 48 minutes, and you don't have to. You don't have to. I'm a sick individual. But, you know, you have to take the pieces that are going to be important to you, because you're going to lock in on those. You know, you don't have to watch 14 games at once in the multi-view, because you're not going to take all that information in. Watch what you want to watch. What's important to you is important to you, and you build on that.
Yeah. I think, just to bounce off of what Steve said, I think scanning the box score, I am looking, if I'm looking for specific games, like I'm looking at like the quarter splits. Did Team X win the fourth quarter by 15 points? If so, okay, wait a minute, what happened here? Was this just y'all hit open threes, the other team didn't? Or was there something that happened? Was there some kind of scheme change, something like that? So I might want to just check out the fourth and see what happened on that front. Or if you, you know, naturally on games like, you know, days like Mondays or Wednesdays, whatever, there's a bunch of games. You may look at the NBA app or whatever. Team's up 14. Like, oh, okay, cool. You check again. Team's up 18. All right, cool. You look back. This team is down 3 points. Like, wait a minute. What happened here? So if you can identify like when that kind of run happened, is something drastic like that. Okay, let me jump in here and see what happened. Or maybe go a little bit before so I can get a sense of what this team was doing well first. And then I can more easily see, okay, this is an adjustment versus, okay, shots just fell or didn't fall, and being able to parse through stuff like that. I also think it depends on like what you're, as I guess as reductive as it sounds, like what you're watching for. Like if you are like, for the rookies in particular, if I see Zach Edey had 21 and 14, like, okay, depending on what I'm using, like I could see, okay, let's look at his buckets and see how he got those. Or something like that. If I wanted to pinpoint something like that. Shea just had 45. Let me look at the Shea buckets and see how he got those. Was there anything different about his night? And like you can glean some of that from the box score. What, Shea was, what, 4 of 8 from 3 in the 45-point game? Like, all right, cool. Were these spot-ups? Was he filled it? Were he going into pull-ups? You kind of, like, that would kind of inform, like, I want to watch this and see what happened here. And then also what Steve said. If there's a team that won that you didn't expect them to against a higher quality opponent or someone that's perceived that way, I may just want to check that out. Let me watch, you know, if not the second half, you know, second quarter plus second half or first quarter plus second half. So I can get a sense of what you were trying to do originally, if things changed in the second half, that kind of thing.
I'd also add matchups. So, okay. It was random, but I did this with Knicks Rockets because we had just talked about the Knicks. I'm thinking, hey, how do they handle small lineups or teams that want to switch? I kind of want to watch that game and just see what they look like against that. So you can kind of balance out, okay, they're facing this team that presents this issue. You know, what does Phoenix do with DeMar DeRozan in Sacramento? What does Sacramento look to attack with DeMar DeRozan against Phoenix? Those type of beats. So there's plenty of different ways to do it. Don't think there's only one way to do it. Yeah, that's what I got.
Yeah. And I think because we generally get the, like, how do you watch question and stuff like that, I will continue to echo, find some team folks that you trust on insert social app here. If you are a Twitter person or a Blue Sky person or whatever the case may be, like, find some beat writers or people that do team-based analysis that you trust. So even if you're not watching a certain team super closely, at least have a sense of what's going on there. So then when you do go back, you at least have a reference point. So I would say, you know, you can find ways to stay at least somewhat informed. That is not a replacement for actually watching and forming your own opinions. You still have to do that. Or you should do that at the very least. But at least having something like that to where, okay, if you don't watch the team for a week, you're not missing literally everything that they do for a week. Have something in the backdrop. So it'll make it a little bit easier for you to catch stuff and focus in on certain things when you're watching. All right, moving to the next question. This one coming from Flint, who says, hey, Nikias and Steve, wanted to know what you both think about adding draft capital incentive to the in-season tournament. I like the concept of the in-season tournament.
No, the Emirates NBA Cup does not need to be touched. No, no, no. Continue.
Well, should I continue?
Yes.
At this point. Okay. Well, fair enough. I like the concept of the in-season tournament.
The Emirates NBA Cup.
But it doesn't feel important at all. Do front offices, coaches, players, or fans really have a sufficient reason to want to win? The players could probably be paid more for winning, but what if the winning team also got the 15th pick in the draft? Expand the draft, maybe. Maybe on a deal that doesn't take away a roster spot and a reduced salary cap hit. I think adding an incentive like that would add legitimate stakes, especially for fans into front office. And also because it ends up being a single elimination that may allow worse teams to go on a run and win it. There would probably be a lot to figure out, though.
All right, Flynn, good question. I came off aggressive, but I'm just being honest with you. So here's the thing, right? Let's have a chat. So if I come in with my quarter zip up. All right, y'all. Big game. We get this one. We get the 15th pick. That is not going over well at all. I'm just being honest with you. You are getting a so what, and you are being called a resident very fast. What I would say is...
That's crazy.
And this is interesting that you asked this year, because if go look at the standings and go look at the cup groups. I promise y'all, it might not, but this NBA Cup is going to get funny. Like, Boston has already lost a game. If they lose to Cleveland, they are not advancing. Like, this could get really tricky. This group with what? Milwaukee, Indiana, Toronto, Detroit, Miami. Who's coming out of that group? Like, this, the whole ideal, and is this a safe space?
Yeah.
The Emirates NBA Cup already did what it was supposed to do. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It served its purpose. Uh-huh. But.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You have this moment where things kind of build up, and whether you know, it's still new, but you start to think about it. You got the colorful courts, the buildup happens. It's Tuesday, Fridays, it's regular nights, becomes routine. As things go on, you get immersion because here's standings. Here's the standings. This game's important. Here's a bracket, a single elimination. So it's something that you may not feel is important, but remember, we didn't always have this. So these games would just be happening anyways. So it's just an addition to the season to kind of build this up. And if the league is going to have that parity early on, you're able to cash in on that where every team is trying to find their way. Every team is a little similar. We add some stakes to it. Now, before you know it, boom, single elimination games are happening. Now we're in Vegas and then it's over. Like, it's not like this prolonged deal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily know, me personally, I'm sure front offices would love that, but from like the coaching player standpoint, brother, I might not be here next year. Why
would I care about this? No, I think I'm laughing because of the presentation, but like, that's a good point. And I think if you are going to further incentivize things, I think it's just going to be the prize pool. Like, I don't think there's another incentive that players may care about. You know what I mean? Like, unless you want to get funny with, like, everybody on the winning team, like, you get three games counted against, like, the games played minimum for award stuff, I guess. So, like, you could be, if you play 60 games, you may still be eligible because you get, like, a +5, do, like, some cap breakers from 2K or something like that. But, like, outside of that, like, I think it's just going to be, can we improve the prize pool to where they're winning more money for getting in there?
I think that's a valid point. And, again, you got to remember, it's only, what, it's 4 games, right? So yeah, the teams that are going for it are going to know they're going for it. So now all of a sudden they're going to be incentivized to go for it, as opposed to, you know, I mean, the teams that aren't, they're going to fall out and they're going to have to play other regular season games. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like you get a break. Like, you still got to go play games. Just not much on the line.
Yeah, I think going back to last year, the only game that didn't officially count was the championship game. Since that was technically, I think, the extra one. But everything else is just a part of the regular season standing. So, like, even if you don't get the extra juice, like, it still matters. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Other than that, I think the only thing I would reasonably suggest is get more money in if you wanted to do that. But I do appreciate the question and the idea. Next one going to come from Richard, who says, hey, Nikias and Steve, love the pod. Thank you. I have a couple of Pistons-centric questions about post-ups. One of the things that is standing out to me about the Pistons offense is that it feels like they are being intentional about getting to post-ups for Cade and Tobias Harris this season, where the post-ups seem designed more to draw help, make a pass, and get the defense in rotation, and then play out of that. It felt like in the first few games of the season that the possessions with Cade were more fruitful than the ones with Tobias. Number one, are there statistics that show how efficient the Pistons have been playing out of post-ups from these two respectively? And at what point in the season could you trust those statistics to be accurate and not skewed because of sample size?
What you got, big number?
Big number is crazy. But I did look up, as of recording, from Second Spectrum, there have been 25 post-ups for Cade Cunningham. There have been 36 for Tobias Harris. On trips featuring a Cade Cunningham post-up, the Pistons are generating 1.22 points per possession, which is an elite mark. And on the possessions featuring a Tobias Harris post-up, it is at 0.91 points per possession, which I think is like right around the league average or slightly below it. Not awful, but it certainly isn't the Cade number. So to answer your early question, you can confirm like the Cade post-ups have been more fruitful, both with him as a scorer and, as you mentioned, drawing extra help, making the passes, generating open shots from that way. And then from, oh, the second question, at what point in the season, with stuff like, I guess it's less part of the season for me, though, obviously you don't want to just take stuff from the first week and say, hey, these are the guys that are good at it. These are guys that are bad at it. I think once you get to, I'd say once you get to December, at least get a month and a half or so in, like that's where it begins to feel reasonable to me. Project like, hey, this is a thing that is generally going well. But for me, it's more so position based, I think. Because like I can cite a guard that's doing well, but if they've only posted up 8 times, like what does that really mean? But I say give it a month and a half or so, and then I feel a little bit better about that in terms of games played or a scheduled threshold. As far as attempts or I guess post possessions, I think for bigs, like get me 40 or 50. For guards or wings, if you get to 20 or 25, it at least signifies to me that this is a thing that you are doing versus like a random early offense transition type beat. So I think that's where I would go on the number front. And then the second question, from a coaching perspective, how long do you stick with something even if it doesn't appear to be as fruitful early on in the season? I personally would have abandoned the Tobias post-ups after the first couple of games, but recently it has felt like they have gotten some good results playing out of that.
I mean, it's good question. I think the thing for me is you want to keep guys involved to a degree. And so if you can run a set and you can have a guard screen for Tobias into a post-up, or you swing the ball, Tobias screens, he gets a switch, he can roll into a post-up. Or, you know, he, you know, pick and pop, drives, now he goes to a post-up. You don't necessarily want to take that out of their game. You don't want to take that out of their DNA. Because, mm-hmm. you know, if he now has it going, mixes in a couple buckets, now you can design some of those post-ups and say, hey, we want to get him a look down here. So it's not something that you regularly, you abandon to a degree. You might not call the set for it, but again, you can't dictate everything. So if you call a set and Tobias feels like he has a matchup, Tobias heads towards the block, hey, you know, but what are you going to do? That's not the play. That's not how it works.
Get back out there.
No, it's just that's not how basketball works. So you kind of have to live with it. I think the thing with me for the Cade post-ups going back to it is, he's getting to them in different ways. Transition, I drove, I kicked. Actually, I'm going to stay right here, throw it back to me. Let's post up. Let's boogie. Empty side pick and roll, you guarded it well. I'm going to back you down. Those type of beats. So it's kind of like the natural rhythm of the game is going to dictate some of that more than just, okay, we have to get Tobias in the post. Because if a team is going to switch a matchup, let's say we get our one on Tobias, hey, that's a lot better than maybe us doing the 2010, 2011, 2012 wing slices to the wing and now catches and faces up Vince Carter, Rudy Gay post up.
Yeah.
I feel bad naming those two, but it's the visual.
No, it's just play type.
Richard Jefferson, you know, those ones. Mm-hmm. Damn, I'm about to get hit.
Oh Lord. Well, hey, we did notify earlier it is indeed the shade spot. Just kidding. But no, like I
the
think
the shade spot. Hey, we're gonna circle back to that, by the way.
But no, in all seriousness, like I think it's still within the threshold. Like Steve said, like you want to at least establish a level of trust there. So trust that we can get to this when we need to. And I think in general with Tobias, like you do want him to be involved as something other than a spacer. Because if you're just going to ask him to stand on the perimeter and knock down shots, that's a thing that he can do. But like you're not getting the full breadth of what he is and what he can be. And at that point, like why wouldn't you just have another wing to just take spot up shots if that's all you want him in there for? And so if you're able to establish him as a threat inside the arc on top of that, he's in a better rhythm. So those catch and shoot opportunities may just be more fruitful. And if teams are switching against Detroit, which they have been quite a bit so far, having another option that could potentially take that off the table ultimately can help you open things up offensively. And I think this thing about Detroit's late game offense and how K-centric it is, and rightfully so because K's really good, like I think it's just generally helpful to have someone else that if you switch against them, we can just beat that. Or we can just go to something else on the low post and play out of that and get generate good offense outside of K do something awesome. So I think the variety does indeed help. Next question going to come from Josh, who signed the email with a sad Pelicans fan. So I think we know where this is going. Hello, Nikaias and Steve. I just watched the New Orleans Pelicans drop another confounding loss to the Brooklyn Nets. I know the team has been massacred by injuries this season, but it just seems like the team is underachieving even for who they have healthy. In particular, I find the lack of offensive creativity alarming. They struggle to bring the ball up the court against pressure and don't seem to be doing much to alleviate that pressure. In the half court, there is very little off-ball action being run to bring someone to the ball or to free up shooters and cutters. When the team brought in James Borrego last season, we saw some improvements on the offensive end. But even when decently healthy last season, the offense routinely fell flat. The Pelicans have also seemingly overachieved defensively in the past based on their personnel. How would you evaluate Willie Green and his staff's job of coaching through the many crises they have faced since he has taken over? And what path feels realistic to move this franchise forward? A big fan of the show. Thank you for the wealth of information you share and the love for the game you guys bring.
Josh, you're going to be mad at me. Good question. Appreciate the support.
I love starting with you going to be mad at me.
I'm being dead honest. If you're looking at Willie Green right now, this ain't the time. This loss you mentioned, the New Orleans Pelicans scored 105 points with a lineup of Brandon Ingram, Yves Missy, Jose Alvarado, Trey Murphy III, Brandon Boston Jr., Jeremiah Robinson Earl, Daniel Tice, Trey Jemison, Javonte Green, Jalen Noel, and Antonio Reeves. That group of players made 42 field goals and had 31 assists. I don't think that's the problem. The problem is no one is healthy right now. You got Brandon Boston Jr. to have 10 assists in a basketball game, and we talking about Willie Green? You got 15 points out of Jeremiah Robinson Earl in 20 minutes. And we're talking about Willie Green. I can't get there. I understand the frustration. I hear it. I get it. But I'm not there. I can't get there. For me personally, I can't even evaluate the Pelicans right now because they aren't the Pelicans. They're a basketball team trying to put enough players on the court to compete. He has had the deck stacked against him how many years now?
It's been, what, 3-4? It's been...
All right. So, I don't think he's going to get the credit for that. You're going to look at the downfall of it, but he had the, well, I guess we got Brandon Ingram, CJ, and Jonas Valanciunas. We're going to make it work. Then you have to reintegrate Zion, and then you have to adjust to when Zion's not there, and you do that a few times. Now, well, we got DeJounte now, and well, he's already gone. So
I had him for a game.
So it's like what I can understand the frustration. Mm-hmm. I think the offense has at times had some of the movement and flow issues where they have found things that have help the movement, and then you now have we have this package for Zion, and you have issues blending in at times. When they do, things go well. But I can't get there with Billy this year. Can't do it.
I feel you. I think I am largely with you in that this team has just been so injured. Like, my Pelicans watching is more, what is Eve Missy doing? I literally talked about Brandon Boston on the last podcast to shout him out for what he's doing. It's more like, who's popping within this context or who's doing cool things versus like a granular analysis of what Willie Green is or isn't doing. Cause like there's just so many pieces moving. Like, I understand it is the NBA, so there is just an element of, well, this is what you got, and we want to win, so do your best. But as far as, like, denigrating him, like, I also can't get there. I think beyond that, the off-ball deal is interesting. I kind of struggle with trying to balance, sure, there could be a little better tempo, a little bit more movement, but also, like, who are you running the movement for? Exactly. Can you build the entire boat out of that? And then ultimately, like, if teams are comfortable just switching or going under your stuff, like, even if you run cool things, it may not work. And I do think in general, funny, I just talked about this recently, but like, I think in general, in the NBA side, W side, whatever, there tends to be this tendency, and I'm not accusing you directly of this, but like, there tends to be this tendency of the offense isn't producing, so clearly something isn't being done about it. Like, it's a similar conversation that I had on the other end when James Borrego left Charlotte. Where it's like, yeah, he's got to go. The defense is bad. He didn't do it. It's like, they tried like 8 different things defensively. They just didn't have the personnel for it. And so, like, the one thing that I would poke at least statistically with New Orleans, and that's, it's just been a talking point for a few years, is like, just how many threes are they taking? But even that's more of a personnel deal. Like, I don't know how much to put on Willie. Like, I don't think he's telling them, hey, don't take those shots. You know what I mean? And like, that's the closest I can even get to head coach has to do something about it. And I can't fully get there. So like, I think once you factor in all of the injuries and all the moving pieces that he's had to deal with through, and this is year 4 for him, I did check, through 4 years, like, I don't have an issue with Willie Green. Like, I think he's done a fine job. Considering all the injuries and things, were like, they just won 49 games last year. Like, that just happened. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't, and like, again, like, maybe part of my opinion is because, like, obviously we talked about the Pelicans, we covered them on the show, but like, because I'm not a Pelicans person, so like, maybe if I was watching all 82, maybe I feel differently. But based on what I've seen, like, I can't get there either.
That man said he's not a Pelican person. That's insane.
No, I'm you know what I mean. And, see, this is how, okay. I see what's going on here.
You said it was a shade spot.
You know what? Fair enough. Next, we're going to come from our dear pal Nico, who says, hi, Nikais and Steve. One of my favorite bits from the watch party, y'all should join those, by the way, is calling Jalen Suggs Gen Z Derek White. But to start the season, Dyson Daniels seems to have taken issue with that with his activity on defense. With this in mind, I guess this is a chance for you both to highlight their performances this season, why they should win most improved player, this is a joke, and how this role of a Derek White plays into the different strategies shown in the league.
Salute to Dyson Daniels.
I will say it is kind of wild to go from a Pelicans question right into Dyson Daniels praise. That is kind of tough. I should have staggered these questions differently. But I have enjoyed the Dyson Daniels experience this season. He is stealing everything, which, if we're talking about the Derek White of it all, he's just flying around. On-ball steals, off-ball steals, some backcourt stuff. Like, he has just been incredible defensively. And then with Jalen Suggs, like, we talked about him earlier in the year where he was shooting the leather off the ball and taking a whole bunch of pull-up threes. Like, that has dipped after the opening week or so of the season. But he remains a menace defensively. We've seen more drives from him. We've seen a little bit more initiation from him, especially since Paolo's been down. And to the general prompt of, like, those types of players, like, those guards that can take on those tough point of attack assignments are important. Like, they can help set the tone for your defense, first and foremost. I think being able to force turnovers specifically, you get out in transition, that's an efficient source of offense for you, or at the very least it should be. And offensively, I think more and more, guards are being asked to do a little bit of everything. Like, as someone that is a sucker for guard screening, like, watching Jalen Suggs, you know, going back to last year, but like, hey, let me feed Paolo a matchup. Let me feed Franz a matchup. And him being willing to do that, and also if he's screening for someone off the ball, like, having that physicality helps open things up. And you see it in Boston with Derek White. Like, he'll screen for Jason Tatum. He'll screen for Jaylen Brown. And he just causes mismatches on the floor. And so I think it's more important, especially if you aren't known as a shooter, to be able to find value in other ways offensively. When you don't have the ball in your hands, I think that's important. And I think Dyson represents that with his cutting in particular. But, like, again, he'll screen for Trey sometimes. You'll see that. Jalen Suggs, again, be used as a screener if he used as a cutter as well, playing off of those guys. So I think it's important for the non, like, elite shooters to be able to find those kind of value adds elsewhere.
I like it. Yeah, also, let me be on record. Most improved coming down to Darius Garland, Wimby, LaMelo Ball, Cam Thomas, and Norman Powell.
There you go. The field is here. The field is here. What do I say? Dyson Daniels doing his thing. Jalen Johnson also doing his thing. I think it's going to be a fun field this year once we actually, like, dig into it. And our final set of questions is going to come from Jake, who says, hi, guys. Thanks, as always, for the great basketball content. Two questions for you guys. One nitty gritty and a fun one. Number one, when defending a guard-to-guard screening action, I feel like there should be more room to try and fight through or navigate the screen with a smaller player setting, but teams almost always switch. Is this going to be something defenses do more of to protect weaker defenders or keep bigs in the paint?
You kind of want to have an automatic sometimes to keep it simple. So if we're switching, we're just switching. That way we don't have to worry about it. Switching deny. Because the issue is, if you give them room, right? Let's say, I'm just imagining, you know, like a guard pin down. If that guard has space and you're trailing the play, and a lot of these offenses, you know, especially with dribble handoff actions, they're designed to make you trail. And because you're trailing and you didn't switch that first screen, you're trailing the second one. You have separation. Your big has to help you. Now your defense is held. So sometimes it's easier to just switch that and not have to worry about, okay, what are we doing in this scenario? You know, it just takes thoughts off the board. I think a lot of times people like to call it soft switching. But when you're explaining it, when you're teaching it, it's easier to say we're switching 1 through 4 than, hey, you know, the game is a much faster game now than it was before. We could say, hey, we're switching everything but our point guard. If our point guard is involved, we're doing this. It's harder to do that when the ball is moving side to side that quick. Teams are playing with so much tempo. You can't get that deep into it outside of the playoffs, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to switch. Also, you got to remember, even if you don't give the switch, that does not mean that they are not going to rescreen to get the switch. It does not mean they're not going to try and get it in a different way. So, okay, cool. We put the point guard in action, and the point guard showed and recovered, didn't want to switch. That's cool. Let's flip it. The player that we actually want to have the matchup, aka shout out to the Boston Celtics, Jason Tatum, you now become a screener. Hey, that person that you're guarding thinks they're a very good defender. They're going to switch. Hey, we got what we want.
Oh, no.
So you flip it on defenses that way. It's a mental game to where we're continuing to poke and prod at you. You know, we see it all the time. Like, I know everyone likes to talk about defenses not being sophisticated. It's so funny to watch. You'll see this almost, you know, not every end of quarter, but so many times. Team wants to exploit a matchup. Defense sees it. They pre-switch it. Get that guy out of there. Hey, here's our good defender. We're good to go. That guy comes to set a screen. You know who else comes? The other person.
The other guy.
Who has the person they wanted to put in the action anyways. And guess what happens? It's a switch because we're switching. And that's like, they are going, you know, you can't run from it anymore. You know, there are ways where you could defend it and hide, or at least, okay, you know, Steph Curry worked his way. He worked his way out of hell. That man said, nope, show. I'm showing again. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. We ain't doing that no more. You go over there. You know? You have to, as a defense, kind of put yourself in that position. Like, and the other part of it is, if we can switch Damian Lillard onto this action and have success with it, now what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. You going to keep going to it? because we're comfortable switching. We're fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's the back and forth of it. So I know it's always a hot button topic. Like, why they just give that switch? It's you're playing, you know, checkers, chess, whatever you want to call it. You're going back and forth. Because now, in theory, as a defense, all I need to do is have enough success to make you not want to do that.
Yep.
If I do that, then you get bored offensively and you do something else, we're fine. If you hit me and now it hurts in the fourth quarter, obviously we got to adjust, but that's kind of some of the theories around it. Sorry, hopefully that was a good answer.
No, that was really good stuff, Steve. Like, it's because I know I was very loud about my disdain for soft switching and have been in years prior. Like, this is something that I brought up on the pod. And, like, we've had the conversations, like, okay, well, that makes sense. Like, I just got to kind of recalibrate my thoughts on this now. Because I've had this explained to me. And like now, just like I don't yell about it as often. Like I don't yell about it as often as like a concept. Like there are specific ones where like, hey, here's this screen at half court. And it's like, okay, well, you probably didn't have to switch that one if you could help it. But like conceptually, I have a better understanding of why teams default to that. Like it's just easier to let's flatten this part out first, and then we'll just show help elsewhere if necessary, versus some of the scheme nuance with teams poking at that kind of thing. And now you got three people trying to compensate for something. And now you're in trouble as a defense. And as you were just talking through examples, stuff like that, you mentioned Jason Tatum as an example as a guy that will screen to get the mismatch he wants. I think about the end of the Heat-Suns game where it felt like Phoenix's entire late game offense was, we are going to have Terry Rozier's man screen to get Tyler Hero into the action. And then we're going to bring up Kevin Durant as a screener. And let's see what you do. They switched, the first couple. Kevin Durant got good stuff. And then Miami was like, well, we're not doing that anymore. Hey, let's just have you just try to navigate the best you can so we can keep Haywood Highsmith on Kevin Durant. And then it quote unquote worked because he didn't get the switch. But then it was KD getting the ball at the top of the key with room to dribble to either side. And he didn't even use the dribble. He just takes a jump over Haywood Highsmith. It's like, well, that's just kind of tough. You know what I mean? And then even recently, recording on a Wednesday right now, like going back to the Tuesday game, the Warriors-Mavericks, that end. And seeing like, hey, why are you giving up the switch? It's like, well, if there's one thing you don't want to do with the Golden State Warriors, even in 2024, is put two on the ball in some capacity with Stephen Curry and Draymond Green involved in action together. So like, no, you probably don't want to switch like Luka onto Steph or insert Mavericks big onto Steph. But if we trap this with the level of playmaking that they have on the floor and the way that they've shot the ball so far this season, we got more things to worry about. So it may be easier to just switch, flatten it out, do your best. And ultimately, again, Steph just hit kill shot after kill shot after kill shot. Like, that's just what he does. That's why he's Hall of Famer, one of the best players ever. But, like, you have a better understanding of, like, why that kind of thing happened. And as to the second question, the fun part. Watching Gary Payton II and Peyton Pritchard guarding each other made me think that if you fuse those two guys together, you'd get a super role player. GB2's defense and athleticism with Peyton Pritchard shooting and ball handling. What other role player fusions can you guys think of where players of similar sizes and very different skill sets could contribute, could combine, and would you be able to get a superstar?
What you got, big dog?
Well, as I pull the old notes app back up, I was like going through teams. I was like, hey, are there teammates that I could have fun with here? And can I get to superstar level? And I think the closest I could get to, well, one, there was just a general who counts as a role player. Because I think that kind of varies depending on who the team is.
How much time you spend on that part?
So much time, man. So much. Because I'm just like, because like, here's the thing, right? Like, it feels disrespectful to call Drew a role player, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I can't call Drew a role player in good conscience, even though, like, within the construct of the Celtics, he is. I don't want to call, Derrick White super role player. But, like, Derrick White's played, like, a borderline all-star this year. Like, I don't know, like, in a vacuum if he's a role player. So, I just kind of eliminated Boston as a concept. I was like, okay, well, this is just going to be easy. if I use any of, like, the Boston starters, really. So, I left them alone. the first duo that came to me, funny enough, as we had a New Orleans question, like Herb Jones and Trey Murphy III.
Do you want to combine them?
Like, if you combine, like, that's a really good, like, Herb, one of the best, if not the best, wing defender in basketball. When healthy, get well soon. Trey Murphy III, bombs away from three, got really good at attacking closeouts. And, like, Herb, quietly, like, solid passer for the position. So, like, if you have good enough passer, elite defense, crazy good three-point shooting, and with distance, if it's not superstar, then, like, that's pretty darn close.
I know you got a list. The first one I thought of was Anthony Simons and Colin Sexton. It's a lot of buckets, a lot of dog.
That is a lot of buckets and a lot of dog. I'll give it to you. Oh, did you have more? I didn't want to cut you off.
No, keep going. You have 17 of these. If you have less than 17, I would be shocked.
Well, I do have less than 17, but again, going with like the same team deal, like Herb Jones, Trey Murphy III, something that popped for me. As I was annoyed with watching basketball yesterday, Khalil Ware and Kevin Love certainly wouldn't hit the superstar threshold. But if you combine those two, that's a darn good center.
Hold on. Are you taking players you don't enjoy and combining them into one player on the same team? I don't think that was the assignment, the guy.
No, that's not the bit.
Okay, my fault.
Continue. No, it's like, hey. But no, I just think like general athleticism, you know, the length of Khalil Ware has that kind of vertical presence, and then like the shooting and the rebounding of Kevin Love, like that's a really good big.
Okay, hold on. Before you reveal your next one, Keldon Johnson and Tim Hardaway Jr. for me.
Ooh, that's a shot Tennessee 174.
We got some drives. That's a lot of makes three. It all, well, I got tied to the height thing. I was like, well, who's the same height?
That makes sense. I had Isaac Okoro and Sam Merrill.
Are they the same height?
I think Okoro's like, what, 6'5", 6'6"? Sam Merrill's around the same size, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Also, the funniest bit that we've left on the table is Caleb and Cody Martin, no?
Well, see, the thing about the contrasting skill sets, that is where it gets hazy. But I had Okoro and Sam Merrill. Derrick Jones Jr. and Nicholas Batum.
Okay.
We like that one.
Are these teammates once again?
Yeah. I said I would save team the stuff. I was like, hey, let me go this route. Because if you go across the league, it gets incredibly funny. Like even to the Anthony Simons bit. I think what Ant is, what, 6'4", right?
Mm-hmm.
So like Anthony Simons and Chris Dunn, anyone?
Mm.
Like give me all of that pull up shooting. Also give me all of that defense. Like that gets incredibly fun to me.
Isaiah Joe and Dante DiVincenzo.
Yeah, you know, give Isaiah Joe the playmaking in the defense. That'd be fun.
Dante DiVincenz Joe.
Wow. Wow. No shot. I cannot believe you just did. Hey, Steve, I got one specifically for you, big dog. As you finish laughing at your own joke. I can't believe. Completely unserious, bro. Unserious. But I think I have a big man duo that would pop you.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly Olynyk and Jalen Duren.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
I figured you would like that. Yeah, you get the shooting and the hashtag hub work. You get the rebounding, lob presence, all the good. Yeah, you know, so I think that's I think that would be a good one.
TJ McConnell and Tavion Mitchell.
Oh, man.
I think that's all the ones I had, man. I'll let you know that's if I think of a different one.
Fair enough. You know, well, I guess I've already used Trey. I'm trying to think another wing shooter. Like, because like, ultimately, I would like to get Jaden McDaniels, like, just more shooting and playmaking. I think that would be incredibly fun. Sometimes, like, 6'8", 6'9". I guess we're doing the same thing, the same team thing. Like, would that just be, like, Jaden and Joe Ingles? Here's the shooting. Here's the pick and roll play. Here's the rangy defense.
Does that make him slower?
Doesn't help my narrative, so no. It okay. Sure doesn't, man. All it right. Sure doesn't. See, the bit is you take the good parts of both. You know what I mean?
Okay,
so,
okay.
Yeah, all so right. You just, yeah. But, you know, you get the nice little contrast right there, and then you, okay. You do the thing. Okay.
Well, yeah.
Josh Okogie and Grayson Allen. Give me that defense. Give me that shooting. You know what I mean? But there are just a lot of those littered throughout the league. I feel like you could have a lot of fun with those. Lindy Waters and Jonathan. No, I'm just kidding. The same height thing would be crazy. Because like, I would love like MPJ and Peyton Watson would be a fun one, but I think there's too much of a height difference there to do that in good conscience. If we're sticking with the same team bit. And I'm going to press the button now before I actually get to 17. And Steve's like, ha, see, I told you so. Steve, any closing basketball thoughts before we get out of here?
Shout out Big Lex. Shout out Big Mama.
There we go. We did get another unrivaled announcement. Big Mama, Stephanie Dolson. Also, Alyssa Thomas. Added to the unrivaled camp. I think the teams are being selected next Wednesday. Mm. So I think by next Wednesday, we will have the entire 36-player field. Mm. So I'm excited to see what the rest of those announcements are going to be. Also next week, the WNBA draft lottery.
Mm.
So we got some fun stuff coming up on the W side. And earlier this week, we had the Tyler Marsh introductory presser. So once again, happy for that guy, proud of him, et cetera. Also noted that the team needs shooting. So I'm excited for the Chicago Sky to please add some shooting to the roster.
Also, you know, the Atlanta Dream did hire a coach.
They did. They sure did. That was announced earlier today. Carl Snesko
is the new head coach of the Atlanta Dream. I believe it was at Florida. Where was he at? Florida Gulf Coast. Third highest winning percentage among active coaches in NCAA D1. He's only behind Gino Auriemma and Kim Mulkey.
Kim Mulkey. That's pretty good coaching company.
So I'm sure we'll dive into it more. But they have a fast pace. He's got a certain way of playing offense that is going to, in theory, address a lot of the concerns and complaints that we have had with the Atlanta Dream.
Oh, man. I mean, a team that can play with tempo and also take shots behind the arc line. That'd be pretty neat.
It's kind of
not the funniest.
Well, no, it's kind of wild. Like, he was there for 23 years.
Yeah.
So it's
and won a lot.
It's intriguing to kind of see. I say this with reverence, I guess, but it's intriguing to kind of see as the W goes places, what the pool of people who want to join or what teams are looking for changes.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take that the wrong way. Please don't. I'm just saying that's a thing that could continue to happen.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. So yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to be bothering our dear pal, Mark Schindler, to see, hey, big dog, I know you've watched them. What should we be taking away here? What are some of the actions I should be looking out for with the Atlanta Dream now? So I'm excited. I'm going to see what this is going to look like. And I think the last thing I would say before we head out of here is I am not over the end of Heat Pistons.
Neither is Eric Spoelstra.
Yeah. With Jalen Rose in attendance, it just...
Look, man. Wow. Look, everyone talks about the Jalen Rose image. Just go back and look at Spo's face once he realized everything that happened. The man was burning with an internal rage. I'm sure he's going to be mad about it for the next 7 business days. Look, tough. Incredibly tough. Incredibly tough. And double tough because, I've said this before, if you watch Miami Heat, you know when the Spo timeout is coming, and Spo's very demonstrative with it. He's going to be at the free throw line right after the event occurs. It's a gift that he has. And in my brain, this is how much I've watched the Heat and Spo. I was like, yep, Spo going to be hot. I didn't even realize he didn't have a timeout until they didn't go to timeout. Like, Spo was just at the free throw line. I was like, all right, yeah, let's see what they draw.
There it is.
And I was like, oh, no. Oh, no. And then he was like, no, Kevin Love, get in there. It's like, well, you don't have the ball. It's like, oh, no. So, yeah, man, I know, man, we ain't got to. Shout out Tyler Hero. Shout out Jake Bickerstaff for a hell of a set to end that game. Kind of ironic. Mm-hmm. Miami had that set against Minnesota to win that game, and then that happened. And then very, like, super uncharacteristic of Spo, and salute Spo. And yeah, man, NBA Cup's going to be funny, dude. I'm saving you from your Heat rant.
Oh, no heat rant. I just, hey, go check out the Tyler Hero section on the last episode of the podcast. That was very well timed as he dropped 40.
Wait a minute, did you just plug your, all right, man, hit the horns.
you said no rants, I go the other way, and now you tell me to hit the horns? Hit the horns.
Richie, hit the button.
Can't have nothing in this house.
Put the horns on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Also, if you haven't subscribed to the Young Man of the Three YouTube account, go ahead and do so. We are on the YouTube channel every Tuesday. So if you want the visual element, we got plays spliced in, some graphics spliced in. So if that's more of your vibe, every Tuesday, we are there. You can follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter and Blue Sky at Steve Jones 20.
Don't.
Don't follow Steve, but like follow him anyway. No. Like, don't follow. Just have like a bookmark tab for his account so you can like see his stuff. But no. Like, don't follow him though. oh goodness. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter if you haven't already. Join us for the online Dunker Spot watch parties if you want to watch some hoops and otherwise just hang with us.
Yeah, I don't want to. Continue.
Well, you know, if you want to listen to me, click on that link in the podcast description. It's free to create your profile. Come hang with some cool folks, or, you know, or don't, I guess. I don't know. Whatever Steve says. But we will catch y'all at a later date.
Oh, I found one more combination, guys. Great show. Anthony Black and Grady.